Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
We thank you for joining us, everybody, live worldwide on the award-winning Close Up Radio. It's a pleasure to have you here today. And it's also a pleasure to kick off part one of our exclusive two-part series with expert witness Dr. Edward Goslin. You know, they say in many professions you have to be a jack of all trades and a master of none, but in the field of emergency medicine, doctors have to do their best to be a master of all. Emergency medicine is, by nature, unscheduled care, and most first presentations of anything emergent or urgent, like a heart attack or stroke or severe abdominal pain, are typically first examined by an emergency medicine doctor in the sometimes frenzied location of a hospital emergency department. Due to the unselected nature of patients and the limited time that can be spent with patients, many factors not under a physician's control can affect the attitudes and even the clinical outcomes of patients. It's no wonder the majority of emergency physicians have been named in a claim for malpractice at least once. Dr. Edward Goslin is a board-certified, residency-trained emergency medical medicine physician, a graduate of Boston University's School of Medicine and the founder of EMG Consulting and Contracting, LLC. He has several decades of practice, both clinically as well as administratively. He has been emergency department director for three separate facilities, and he also provides litigation support services and expert witness investigation and testimony in the field of emergency medicine for consultations, affidavits of merit, depositions, and trials. To become an expert witness, he says, you have to be an expert. And Dr. Goslin has spent more than 30 years in emergency medicine and continues to practice. Says it's very hard to be both an expert witness in this field unless you continue to practice. And he has seen doctors attempt to do this work soon after their residency, although they may be board certified with the full completion of education. They may not necessarily have the expertise or nuanced experience. It's a real pleasure. This, again, is part one of an exclusive two-part series we're doing on Close Up Radio with expert witness Dr. Edward Goslin, coming to us live and direct today on this episode of Close Up Radio from Bridgewater, New Jersey. Dr. Goslin, thank you very much for joining us here on Close Up Radio today. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate being on the air with you, Tim.
You're very, very welcome, and we look forward to really diving in deep and breaking out what it is you do and why you love it so much. What initially sort of inspired you to go into this field, to go into initially medicine and really understand it and apply it in the way that you do? I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, board-certified, resident-trained, emergency medicine physician. So you obviously have a real thirst to want to help with healing and help sort of inspire people, which is a beautiful thing through your work. What first introduced you to medicine? What was that inspiration initially for you, doctor?
Well, my uncle was a ENT physician, rather, ear, nose, throat. He initially was eyes, ears, nose, and throat, had to give up the eye practice, and he actually developed an allergy and immunology practice after he gave up eye. And as a kid, I used to drive my bike about a mile and a half after school every day just to go to the office, and my job was, of course, to scrub the test tubes and clean up everything, and basically I was a chief cook and bottle washer, and he was very much a hero to me. This was a guy that not only was incredibly intelligent, but was like just, you know, life vitality itself. He drove a motorcycle. He was a private pilot. He flew a plane. You know, he would let me sit in the right seat and say, okay, it's yours now. And going down to Florida on one flight, one trip, and, you know, of course, I was able to not really fly it, but at least put my hands on the wheel and my feet on the pedals for a little bit. And, you know, he pretty much did everything that there was to do. You know, everything from driving a bulldozer and a backhoe to, you know, having a successful practice. And, you know, just observing him and even his backwoods treatment of me for a nasal fracture and otitis media and doing tympanoplasties, you know, he did to me on the top of a dining room table up in our cabin, you know. I just thought it was amazing that he had the skill set that we could go with him wherever he went, you know, and multiple skill sets, really. So it was just, it was a lot of fun watching him practice. I'm glad I didn't actually, he unfortunately passed away, and I'm glad I didn't take over his practice, because probably the thing that I enjoy the least is ear, nose, and throat.
Yeah. But again, it's something that is something of a great passion in a way that I really think that it really is an advantage having that extraordinary healthcare medical background, the understanding of the human condition and just what it's all about, healing and getting back to good health. All of that, I think, is extraordinarily valuable for you in the work that you do as an expert witness. I mean, you've been there. You know the ins and outs yourself as a medical expert in the way that you are. Out of all of this comes EMG consulting and contracting. Tell us about the transition to that and the creation and vision. What was your mission when you created EMG consulting and contracting? And tell us about some of the incredible work you do.
Well, I've been fortunate, some would say not so, but I am actually quite fortunate to have worked in a variety of different situations. I've worked for a medium-sized group where I was a part owner in the group, and I've worked for larger contract groups, national groups, regional groups, et cetera. I've also worked a couple of times. I was hired by one group to be an emergency department director, and I worked from everything from a very small rural environment to the South Bronx, which, as you can imagine, is quite large. And this group kept bringing me back. You know, I ended up having a great deal of administrative experience also. And then at one point I had teaching experience. I still, to this day, love to teach. And in New Jersey, one of the largest residency programs for emergency medicine, I was able to teach the residents. There were 11 residents a year for 3 years. So we would start with like 33 emergency medicine residents. And, you know, I would love to, you know, to teach them. And then, of course, you know, I believe in the both autodidactic and didactic, you know, kind of a older style of I will ask you questions and then, you know, you then give me not just answers, but scenarios and scenario-based education and what you would do with that. So, you know, I'm a believer that long before I wanted to do anything in the expert witness field, I had to be an expert myself. And that took, you know, quite some time to be able to be. I believe, you know, in medical school, you go through 4 years. And even though some schools start with hands-on on day one, for the most part, you're really not hands-on till your fourth year. And then as a resident, you're really learning at, you know, you're drinking from a fire hose. You know, and by the time you're at the end of your second year, when you have 1 year left, you should know about 98% of the material, but you may not know things like how to be efficient, how to be effective, how to do charting, kind of the politics of emergency medicine, you know, how to see volume, how to see a larger amount of patients. You know, so you learn that. And then when you practice, you're in so many, especially like myself, in so many different environments that I learned everything from rural to suburban to academic to inner city environments. And each one presents their own conundrums and their own challenges. They can all be fulfilling, but I didn't really even want to get into litigation support services until I felt that I was really an expert. And at this point, after over 30 years of doing this and having this company that I set up about half a decade ago, I've been able to assist the lawyers, and they'll call me, and we will spend, you know, 15, 20, half an hour, even an hour sometimes on the phone, and they'll go through everything, and that is, you know, gratis for me speaking with them. They can decide whether to use me or not, but I'll typically hear their case and try on an initial evaluation without review of the documents to see if they actually have a case or not, whether it's for the plaintiff or for the defense. And at that point, there has been a couple of cases that I said, you know, listen, I'm more than happy to help out. But I try to rate things on a scale of like 1 to 100, like 100 is the slam dunk case, and 1 is, you know, you have a 1% chance of getting somewhere with this, and I'll be upfront and honest with them because I want to provide that support and then let them decide if they want to go forward or not. And the majority of them do, but, you know, some decide not to, and that's fine.
So when, you know, you get back to looking at all of this, it's sort of like a time machine in so many different ways. You know, we're talking about why you chose medicine, but this expert witness area of expertise to me is absolutely fascinating. Your mentors themselves pretty much sort of conditioned you along the way to accept big challenges, which you've been doing so beautifully, right?
Yeah, I think everybody needs to have a mentor, whether it's in business, it's in medicine, you know, wherever. I've had quite a few along my travels, so to speak. Of course, your residency, I'm still best friends with, you know, half my residency class. You know, we'll do vacations together and such. You know, some people, you know, become bonded with their grade school pals and some people with high school or college. To me, it was really my residency. I still stay in touch with you know, one of them on a daily basis. Another one, very often, we just went on vacation together. And literally, the word internship means you are interned in the hospital. You stay there, you know, and residency means you are residing there. So the amount of work product, at least when we were there, you know, everybody says that when we were kids, you know, we had to walk up the hill to school barefoot in the snow both ways. But there is some truth to that. You know, before there was some, there was a legal case that I won't get into, but it basically limited the amount of hours that residents could put in. That, of course, happened after we graduated our residency. There were times in trauma where we were working 134-hour weeks. You know, you were lucky if you're getting a couple hours of sleep every other day for an entire month. So, you know, if that doesn't bond you with the people and make them family when you're there, then pretty much nothing will, you know?
Yeah,
so,
right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you look at all of this, this love of emergency medicine, what is it specifically for you, doctor, about emergency medicine? We have several family members who are in the medical field, nurses, doctors, emergency room as well. Some work with the physically, mentally challenged. I mean, we've just had a variety of different, and I hear their stories. And boy, you know, bless them all for the last 2 years of heroic effort that they've all had to endure and deal with the pandemic and all. But for you, you know, working in emergency medicine, it's almost like a daily thing in an extraordinary way. What is it about emergency medicine specifically that speaks to you?
Well, there are specialties, and then there are subspecialties. You know, you could be a pediatric immunologist, or you can be a pulmonologist, and you deal only with, you know, the lung issue all day long, you know, every day.
Looks like the doctor's call dropped during the show, so we're going to dial back, gang, for those listening. Yeah. Technology is crazy.
Hello?
There you are.
guys, I guess we got dropped somehow.
Did a bird fly over the house or something, maybe? Or you never know, right? But to you, it's nothing because you've worked in emergency medicine. That's nothing.
Always prepared for what they have.
And that's the thing. This day and age, anything can happen, exactly, especially with crazy technology.
Well,
you were saying you were expressing
about emergency medicine. It's like whatever walks in the door, you have to deal with.
Yes.
Like that. You know, it's something that you don't
expect.
Same
thing in this industry, too, exactly. Be ready.
Right. Exactly. You know, for me, I never wanted a very narrow field, you know, even though cardiology is fun, pulmonology is fun, whatever the specialties and subspecialties may be fun, I really felt that I'd probably be bored, you know, only honing in on one particular item. In emergency medicine, you know, you have to have, you know, pediatric skills and obstetrics, gynecology, and internal medicine, and surgery, and, you know, pretty much whatever, you know, psychiatry, et cetera, whatever walks in the door, you have to be able to deal with it. And for us, actually, even though they call us an emergency department, about, it all depends on the department that you work in, but sometimes half or even a little bit more is non-emergent. It's unscheduled, you know, chronic care or an acute exacerbation of a chronic condition, and then maybe 25% are urgent care, and typically only 10, 15, 20 at most are percent of your patient population and volume is actually emergent. You know, an emergent, we triage a level 1 through 5. A 1 means you're thumping on somebody's chest and they're doing CPR as they walk in the door and you have to connect them to a breathing machine and intubate them. That's a 1. A 5 is like, you know, you had sutures in a week ago. Let's take a look, make sure it's healing up okay, or maybe suture removal or something like that. And most of our care is 2, 3, 4. And it takes a curve for the ones. Hello?
You seem like, are you on a cell phone? It seems like your cell is breaking up a little bit. Maybe moving around
in
the room.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like your cell phone's breaking up a little bit. Maybe that's why it dropped the call. Maybe if you move around a little bit in the room, you might get a stronger signal.
Okay.
My bad.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
That's okay. Maybe on the second episode, you might want to use a landline. It's more...
Yes.
A little bit safer sometimes. But who has landlines anymore?
Right. Well, yeah. I'm visiting my sister, so, you know.
Exactly. But, you can continue. Yeah, your thought.
Oh, I didn't know if you heard what I said.
You want to repeat it? It broke up a little bit there.
Sure. Okay. Well, I was just saying emergency medicine, basically, the majority of what we see is non-emergent. Some of it is urgent, and then a smaller part is emergent. And emergent is, you know, you're doing CPR on somebody and connecting to the breathing machine and, you know, rapidly giving drugs, and somebody is on the verge of death. And, of course, non-emergent, you know, we triage between a level 1 and 5. 1 is that serious patient who's, you know, at death's doorstep. 5 is like a suture removal or a wound check 3 days later or something. It's nothing that's in the least emergent or urgent. So, and it's like a bell curve. We mostly see level 2, 3s, and 4s, but, you know, we see probably more 1s than 5s. You know, but you have to be ready for everything at the drop of a hat. You know, so you really kind of have to keep your skills sharp
in order to be ready for whatever walks in the door.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right. It's amazing. When it's time to go, you just go, right? Kind of like a samurai. You just got to dive right in and go. Let's talk about, again, that introduction to the expert witness work, which really is fascinating. Are the cases that you're working on, are they always related to malpractice of an emergency medicine physician, or is there a variety of things that you're really specializing in, doctor?
Well, as an expert witness, I'm expert in emergency medicine. So by definition, it involves an emergency medicine provider, whether it's a physician or a mid-level provider or a PA or a nurse practitioner or somebody associated with the emergency department. Maybe the person went to, you know, have a radiologic procedure but was based in the emergency department. Basically, their management came from the emergency department, which for a lot of patients, that is pretty much a hospital sees most of its patients on average through the emergency department. A certain segment of them are admitted to the hospital, but typically the average patient goes through the emergency department, whether they're discharged or admitted or referred. Of course, you have, you know, plaintiff cases and defendant cases. So, you know, it may be the hospital or the provider or whatever is involved on one side or the other with the particular case. You know, so my job is to be able to tease through the records. First of all, hear the case. Second of all, tease through the records and see whether there is a case to be made for their particular claim. And many times there is. Many times it's a strong case. Many times it's one of those I call fence sitters. It could go either way, depending on, you know, if the case ever went to a trial. And I'll let the lawyers, you know, the counselors know how I feel after going through the records. But there is a progression, too, that you go through. If I don't feel they have a case, I will tell them right away. I can't stop them from going one way or another, but I'll say, I really don't think you have a case. If I think you have a moderate case, I just consulted on one within the last week or so, and I said, it's really a fence sitter. It's 50-50, depending on how, you know, the particular facts are viewed. And then, you know, I think some are very, very strong and have a very good case. In fact, they're almost kind of like layups or slam dunks. And in the legal profession, you have what's known as either a fact witness or an expert witness. A fact witness is just testifying to the facts of a particular case, whereas an expert witness is called because of their expertise in a certain field. And if it involves an emergency medicine provider, then I would need to be able to be involved if the case proceeded. And typically the first step is you would see if they do have a case, I would provide something called an AOM, which is an affidavit of merit saying that, yes, this case should proceed forward or should be allowed to be filed. And after that, I would review all the records. I've usually reviewed all the records by this time, but I would re-review all of the records and write an expert witness testimony, which would then also be filed. And that, if it continued forward, could go to depositions and then ultimately could go to trial. And typically at any point during this process from before the AOM till at trial itself, before a verdict would be reached, you know, the parties could always opt to settle. And sometimes, a lot of times that happens if one party or another feels that their case is either very strong or very weak per se, and you know, would not want to take the chance of having it go to a jury trial and a decision by an impartial jury.
It's really fascinating. It really is. You know, people are litigious, of course. Emergency rooms are frenzied mm-hmm. environments. How are emergency mm-hmm. care physicians not being threatened with lawsuits almost every day? I mean, you would assume because things are happening so fast that, you know, mistakes can happen from time to time just because of the frenzied nature of what's going on.
Oh, I absolutely agree. The average emergency medicine physician gets named in a case about once every 4 years, I believe, is the average right now. I am, knock on wood, fortunate enough to have never had a monetary decision in almost a third of a century of practice against me, you know, which is good. But I believe a lot of that, I've known residents who have been sued three times during their residency, you know, in the 3 years of their residency. And I'm a firm believer that the first, you know, when I would teach my residents in emergency medicine, and 33 of them would gather for our introduction, and 11 new residents and 22 from the other 2 years. And, you know, some of the ones who know me, they'd start to smile a little bit because we'd introduce ourselves as a faculty and as a staff. And I would kind of tell them, all right, guys, here's the ladies and guys, here's the deal. And the real deal is, you know, every single one of us fit into one of three categories. We're either stupid, ignorant, or lazy. I'm like, if you're ignorant, I'm ignorant of things. Ignorance is simply lack of knowledge. It means I can't, you know, right now, you could put me in a room with all the tools necessary. I probably couldn't build a spaceship to the moon. You know, I don't know if you put Elon Musk in the room, if he could do it. He could fund it, but I don't know if he could actually do it. He's a pretty smart guy. So I said, ignorance is great. It means that we need to be taught. We can teach each other. We can all learn. I have no problem with that. That's great. Something like stupidity, this may sound, you know, not the best way to put it, but I think it gets the point across. I said, it means that you can learn to a certain level. You know, if you have an IQ of, you know, 100, you can learn to that level. If you have an IQ of 130, you can learn to that level. If you have an IQ of 160 or 180 or 200, you can learn to that level. And that's fine. We will teach you to whatever level you can learn and help you. Hopefully you will become a competent provider. But the main point of me telling them this is I said, I can't countenance lazy. Lazy is you're not getting up to see the patients. You're letting your coworkers and your colleagues do more work than you. You're not going in to reevaluate the patient. You're not appropriately looking, because if you think about it, the universal complaint is, oh, the doctor didn't spend any time. And there may be some truth with that we don't spend huge amounts of time, certainly not like the nurse does. But 90% of the time that we are doing, if we spend 5 minutes in the room with you or 10 minutes in the room with you, I can guarantee you that 8 to 9 times that amount of time is being spent at the desk looking at your lab results, looking at your radiology results, putting everything together and figuring out what it is that you have, especially if it's something a little bit more complicated. And then speaking to consultants, making sure that you have appropriate follow-up, you know, what's called closing the loop. So that takes a large amount of time to do that. And if you're somebody, and it starts when you're a resident, I mean, it starts when you're a little kid. You know, if you're not cleaning your room and mommy and daddy's doing everything for you and you're not, you know, volunteering to wash the dishes and get in there and get dirty and do whatever is necessary to keep the house functioning, well, there might be a strong chance that you're not putting the work in. You're not going to put the work, you're not going to have the work ethic and get a good work product out of what you're doing, and that leads to mistakes, and that leads to malpractice because you're not thinking worst first and making sure you're eliminating those things that can be really serious. We in emergency medicine, we really care about what can cause mortality or death and what can cause morbidity or serious and permanent injury. If we miss something that's small, you know, a little tiny rash, or something, that's not going to be a big deal. But if you miss one of the major rashes that are going to kill you, that's important.
Yeah, exactly. Want to let the audience know you'll be back on Monday, the 25th of April, for part two at 1 p.m. Eastern. A pleasure, Doctor. The half hour has dipped by in a New York minute, but a real pleasure having you on the show. A very special guest, Dr. Edward Goslin, emergency medicine expert witness of EMG Consulting and Contracting, LLC. Fascinating conversation, Doctor, and a great part one, and looking forward to part two. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Oh, no problem. And just one last thing, if anybody did want to look at my website, it's on the SEEK website, S-E-A-K. You just look under Emergency Medicine and Dr. Edward Gosselin, and that would be my website.
Gosselin is spelled G-O-S-S-E-L-I-N. Dr. Gosselin, thanks for joining us. Have a terrific weekend. We look forward to the return visit on Monday. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. You take care. Jim Masters here, thanking you for your time this time. Till next time, right here on Close Up Radio. We appreciate you as well. Stay tuned. We'll be back momentarily with another amazing guest right here on Close Up Radio. Till then, for all of us, have a terrific day. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television, Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.